is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, Kaiser Family Foundation is out with its monthly report on America's mood regarding healthcare and health policy. The gap between those both for and against healthcare law is now narrowing, with a majority of those polled on both sides of the issue feeling concerned about the rising cost of healthcare.
Well, the Kaiser Foundation report card showed that those opposed to the health law actually dropped from 49% to 44%. But it looks like there are other issues more dominant in American minds right now, Mark. The report showed 80% closely following the recent mass shooting in Orlando and had concerns about the prevalence of gun violence.
Such a tragedy. And the members of Congress took their matters into their own hand for a brief moment. Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut held his 15-hour filibuster on the Senate floor, demanding the Senate vote on several gun-related laws. That was followed by a sit-in in the House of Representatives. The debate on the gun law has gotten louder and more pronounced. And while a recent poll shows that 90% of Americans believe there should be stricter gun laws on the book, we need to continue to sound the drumbeat on this serious public health issue, Margaret.
Indeed. And the CDC recently released its statistics on gun-related deaths in this country, revising the number up over 34,000 people killed each year. So certainly not a problem that's going away on its own. And we were very glad to see lawmakers standing up on this very important issue. Too many people are dying.
You're right. Absolutely. And speaking of mortality, a Stanford economist has garnered quite a bit of attention for a study he conducted that shows that the life expectancy rate has gone down for the poorest Americans, while life expectancy has actually increased for the well-to-do. It's a significant finding.
Raj Chetty has been studying the impact of zip code and economic status on health and wealth outcomes, something that all public health people are very focused on as well.
Lori Robertson also stops by. She's the managing editor of FactCheck.org and looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Raj Chetty in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Vice President Joe Biden has outlined goals for the cancer moonshot moving forward. After a day-long summit linking researchers and clinicians from around the country, Biden outlined measures that would reduce bureaucratic barriers, accelerate development of treatments, and ease the flow of data sharing between clinicians and researchers. Among proposals intended to bypass inefficiency at the federal level, Vice President Biden announced the formation of an Oncology Center of Excellence at the Food and Drug Administration, which will coordinate and review all of FDA cancer treatments. It comes as scientific advances in diagnostics allow for greater tailoring of drugs to an individual's genetic profile. Biden outlined a slew of other collaborations and initiatives, including making it easier for patients to find and enter clinical trials through the creation of a cancer trials website and making it easier for scientists to focus on research and less on raising money. Biden also warned researchers who receive federal dollars and don't share their findings could lose that funding. Congress has failed to come to agreement on the Zika funding proposal put forth by President Obama and backed up by the heads of the CDC and NIH. Meanwhile, communities and researchers are taking it upon themselves to prepare for the worst of the onslaught. Research is being conducted now on just how long an infected man can carry the virus and then possibly infect a partner, then causing potentially damaging birth defects if a pregnancy results. Meanwhile, the first Zika-exposed infant has been born with microcephaly in the U.S. Physician burnout is a real phenomenon affecting thousands of medical professionals, and often the trend starts in the grueling days of internships and medical residencies. So the New England Journal of Medicine has a new tool. They've launched a tool to help guide doctors in training through the pitfalls and challenges of a typical residency. The New England Journal of Medicine Resident 360 offers residents a platform for talking about everything from salary to difficult conversations with patients to coping strategies for those long, strenuous shifts. The site also provides educational tools to help residents prep for new rotations and other professional interactions. And this news should go over like butter. Butter consumption has declined in the decades since a 1970s study linking consumption of saturated fat and heart disease. But more recent studies have examined the nuances of types of saturated fats found commonly in red meat and dairy products. And a recent study concluded a moderate consumption of butter did not negatively impact heart health and actually might help reduce diabetes risk by about 4%. They do caution, though, it's still a high source of calories, so moderation is key. But don't hesitate to butter up, Buttercup. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Raj Jetty, PhD, professor of public economics at Stanford University, where he studies the impact of geography and policy on health and economic outcomes. Dr. Jetty previously was the Bloomberg Professor of Economics and the director of Lab for Economic Application and Policy at Harvard University. He began teaching at UC Berkeley, where he was tenured at the age of 27. Dr. Jetty is editor of the Journal of Public Economics. He's won numerous prestigious awards for his work, including the MacArthur Foundation Fellowship in 2012, and the John Bates Clark Award from the American Economic Association for significant contribution from economists under the age of 40. He's also been named by The Economist and The New York Times as one of the most influential economists in the world. He earned his bachelor's and PhD from Harvard. Raj, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you.
And I think it's axiomatic in the public health circles that zip code is a better predictor of health than genetic code. And you've gained quite a reputation in the economic world for conducting some important research on the link between person's economic status, their neighborhood, and both their health as well as their economic outcomes. And I'm wondering if you can help our listeners understand the impact on zip code and economic status on health outcomes and how this came to be the focus of your research.
We've been interested in our research group in studying determinants of inequality and opportunity in the United States. You know, we all worry a lot about growing inequality in the U.S. There are two aspects that have struck me as particularly important, and those are inequalities and opportunities for children and inequalities in health. So motivated by that, we had done some earlier work in our group focusing, as you noted, on economic outcomes and how they vary across neighborhoods. So there's a long-standing debate in social science on whether neighborhoods and the environment in which you grow up has an important impact on long-term success. And using big data drawn from de-identified tax and social security records, we examined in that work how the neighborhood in which you grew up affects your chances of climbing up the income ladder, and found that neighborhoods played a profound role in children's chances of success. I then wanted to turn to the second aspect of inequality that I think is very important, health aspects. And there we used data from, again, social security records linked to tax records, which gave us information on 1.4 billion observations covering the entire U.S. population again, allowing us to look at the link between income and mortality rates and how that varied across counties in the United States. And we find that higher income people tend to live longer lives than lower income people in the U.S. as a whole. But importantly, we find that there's a great deal of variation across areas. And that finding then motivates follow-up analysis to ask, you know, why is it that there are some places where gaps in life expectancy are much larger and growing over time? And why is it that there are some places where we see much less inequality in health outcomes?
Well, Raj, I was particularly struck by your findings that those in low-income groups have actually seen their life expectancy decrease since the Great Recession, while those in upper-income brackets saw their life expectancy increase, adding to an overall difference in life expectancy about 3 years. And, of course, that's gathered a tremendous amount of attention. What are your sort of preliminary thoughts, or what's the next avenues of research zeroing in on what are the causes?
Right. So there's some alarming trends in terms of inequality and life expectancy in the U.S., which, as you noted, we're seeing in recent years very large expansions on average in the gaps in life expectancy between the rich and the poor. Since 2000, the rich have gained about 3 years in life expectancy. In contrast, the lowest income Americans have gained nothing, essentially, on average in life expectancy over the past 15 years. and some might actually have seen reductions in life expectancy. Now, this national fact turns out to be very heterogeneous across areas. There are some places in America where gaps in life expectancy are actually shrinking. Birmingham, Alabama is a place where low-income individuals happen to be gaining as much in life expectancy as the richest Americans. In contrast, there are other places like Tampa, Florida, where the life expectancy of the lowest income population is actually steadily falling over the past 10 or 15 years. And so what's next in terms of this sort of research, I think it's really to understand what is it that's different in Birmingham relative to Tampa, and how can we learn from places like Birmingham? How can we replicate those successes in places like Tampa?
Well, the sort of the mega look at this is that health is wealth. But I think we've known for some time that poverty and social determinants are linked to poor health outcomes, unemployment, low wages, immigrant status and the like. And all of these have impact on population health. I wonder if you could sort of illuminate what kinds of social determinants you looked at while conducting the study and what were the most prevalent factors contributing to mortality divide between those that have the resources and those that don't.
Yeah, certainly. One set of factors is the factors that affect health conditional on income. So at a given income level, we see that people have higher life expectancy and better health outcomes in some areas relative to others. And you can ask, what is correlated with those differences in health outcomes? And what we find there is by far the strongest predictor of the variation across areas is differences in health behaviors, rates of smoking, rates of exercise, rates of obesity, and other habits that we think from prior work are strongly associated with better health. In contrast, we find much weaker correlations with measures of healthcare access, so the number of primary care physicians in an area, measures of the quality of local healthcare, and so forth. There's some predictive power for some of those measures, but nothing like the predictive power of differences in health behaviors. So a different way to ask the question is to say, if we just look at average health outcomes without controlling for income, so there's some places that generate economic outcomes that are not as good, and those worse economic outcomes also tend to be worse health outcomes. So this ties back to the earlier body of work that I was mentioning at the beginning, where we've also looked at how economic outcomes of children in particular vary across areas. And there we find that places that are more segregated or places that have less social capital and less stable family structures, these places have worse economic outcomes. And those economic outcomes tend to go hand in hand with worse health outcomes because we find this very strong correlation between lower income and worse health or lower life expectancy. So there's one set of factors that we should be thinking about, health behaviors in particular, that affect health. And then there's another set of factors that affect both economic outcomes and health together. And I think both are very important to think about from a policy perspective.
Well, Rajay, I don't think it's an overstatement to say that your research highlighted a few bright spots in the narrative, that while life expectancy decreased for those in the lower income brackets, low-income people tended to do better if they lived in an urban area with a robust healthcare infrastructure. And we often wonder how much of a role healthcare infrastructure plays, but this would tend to suggest it does play a role. Can you share your findings with us on health outcomes for the more economically challenged that had the good fortune to live near better health systems? And how does this pattern play out around the country?
Yes. Yeah, so the pattern we're finding is that the lowest income individuals tend to have the best health outcomes in cities like New York and San Francisco, for example. So urban areas with actually relatively high costs of living, liberal, progressive cities that have a lot of spending on public health infrastructure and so forth. Now, why exactly do we see that pattern? We don't know exactly what the answer is. One possibility is that these types of cities tend to be exactly the places that have regulations that might improve the health of the entire population. So, for example, what are the cities where smoking bans in workplaces or bans on trans fats are enacted? They tend to be places like New York and San Francisco. And those types of legislative changes would affect not only the health of the rich, but also the health of the poor. Another possibility is that if you live in an area with a lot of affluent people, educated people who themselves are quite healthy, maybe you yourself change your health behaviors, or there's a greater availability of healthy foods, exercise options, and so forth. A third possibility is that the low-income people who live in New York and San Francisco are just different from the low-income people who live in cities where we find much lower life expectancies, like Detroit or Tulsa, Oklahoma. So again, the robust pattern we find is life expectancy for the poor is higher in urban, affluent, educated areas. Now, more broadly, urban areas tend to have better outcomes than rural areas, conditional on income. Often we find in other studies that the South tends to exhibit worse outcomes. In this case, we find that the South actually doesn't look like it has worse health outcomes than the rest of the country. However, because incomes are on average lower in the South, on average health outcomes in the South look worse. But we think that's because the economic outcomes in the South are worse on average. So again, getting back to the issue that the economic and health outcomes are really intertwined here.
We're speaking today with Raj Chetty, PhD, professor of public economics at Stanford University, where he studies the impact of geography and policy on health and economic outcomes. Dr. Chetty previously taught at Harvard University, where he was the Bloomberg Professor of Economics and the director of the Lab for Economic Applications and Policy. Raj, you've been examining disparities in income and housing and education for a number of years, and I know one of the studies gained a great deal of attention and showed that children born in poverty who were still living in high poverty communities by their early teens are unlikely to ever elevate themselves out of that poverty to achieve the so-called American dream. I know as an organization that provides primary care, we're just about to go into the city of Hartford and take on a pediatric practice of 15,000 children. I was thinking about that as we were preparing for the show and really concerned about all the work that we might be able to do might not change their trajectory. And I'm wondering if you could share some details of your study on childhood poverty and the impact on economic mobility as well as health outcomes.
Absolutely. So we do think that neighborhoods can have a profound effect on childhood poverty. That's not to say that other interventions like direct health interventions, improving primary care, for instance, mm-hmm. don't matter. So what we did in the study that you're referring to is we examined children who moved to lower poverty or higher opportunity areas and examined how their outcomes changed. And in particular, in one of the studies, we focused on a well-known experiment called the Moving to Opportunity Experiment, which involved about 5,000 families in five large cities in the U.S. And these families, some of them were randomly assigned a housing voucher that gave them access, gave them money to move to a lower poverty area, while other families that were in the control group ended up continuing to live in quite high poverty public housing projects. And so essentially, we've tracked the children in this experiment over about a 20 or 25 year period. And we're able to look at how growing up in a high poverty versus a low poverty area, how that affects your long-term outcomes. And what we find is that the children who were given the opportunity to move to a lower poverty area at a young age end up having dramatically better outcomes. They're earning 30% more as adults. They're significantly more likely to go to college. They're significantly less likely to have a teenage pregnancy. In contrast, children who moved at older ages, when they were teenagers, for instance, mm-hmm. exhibit much, much smaller gains from moving to these lower poverty areas. So what these data show is that neighborhoods matter through a mechanism of childhood exposure. Every extra year that you spend growing up in a better area appears to improve your long-term outcomes. Therefore, if you move at a young age, you get a big gain from moving to a lower poverty neighborhood. But if you move when you're older, you don't see much of a gain at all in terms of economic outcomes. Now, when one looks at health outcomes, again, you see significant improvements when people move to higher opportunity areas. Here, interestingly, we find significant gains even for people who moved at older ages, even for adults. Prior studies have shown that there are significant improvements in terms of mental health, reduced rates of diabetes, and so forth. So neighborhoods really seem to play a very important role in both economic and health outcomes. But let me reiterate that that study does not show by any means that other interventions, like primary care interventions mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or improvements in schools in a given area and so forth, do not matter. The lesson is simply that neighborhoods are one powerful determinant of economic and health outcomes.
Raj, the work you do at Stanford, along with your colleagues around the country, would seem has accelerated in recent years, partly because of the advances in having big data. Tell us, how much has that impacted the kind of research that you're able to conduct? And maybe equally importantly, how are you able to translate that data to inform policymakers or lawmakers who are developing policies that can help impact some of these pressing social problems? So tell us more about how your data is influencing policy that will directly affect equality of opportunity in the country.
Yes, so there's really been a transformation in social science in recent years as the field has shifted from using data from small surveys, where you really have limited samples and particular difficulty in tracking people over time, to the use of what is colloquially called big data, large data sets that are created through our interactions with various systems like the tax system or the social security system, or here in Silicon Valley, things like Facebook and Google end up generating a lot of data. And the vision of our research group is basically that we can harness these data not just to improve the products that the private sector offers. So here in Silicon Valley, you hear a lot about how you can use these types of data for marketing purposes, for instance. Our vision is we can use these data to tackle important social and economic policy questions. One of the things I'd emphasize is that it's critical for the United States to continue to provide researchers access to these sorts of data. Mm-hmm. And much of my interaction with policymakers in D.C. and other levels of government is around showing the very valuable lessons that you can get from these data, which translate directly into policy. So, mm-hmm. for instance, the Housing and Urban Development Agency is thinking about changing the way in which the $45 billion a year we spend on affordable housing programs is structured in light of the evidence that I've been describing. So seeing that very tangible impact mm-hmm. on policy, I think motivates policymakers to recognize the value of these data and creating an infrastructure where researchers can access these data and deliver lessons that can improve scientific knowledge and help public policy more broadly. There's much, much more to be done, but I think this is really a promising way to mm-hmm. study important questions going forward.
You know, as you were talking about better outcomes in urban, affluent, educated areas and that neighborhoods matter, it had me reflect on a couple of people we've talked with in the past, Robert Putnam and his work at Bowling Alone, and Nick Christakis, mm-hmm. who's been working on social networking, and really both of them coming out of a little variation on the theme. I'm wondering, as you sort of think about the work you're doing and others are doing, and what's your recommendation for people who are frustrated with all of this data in terms of the work that they can do?
Yeah, I mean, Mark, you're absolutely right that there's a connection to the work of Bob Putnam and Nick Christakis here. As an example, we find that Salt Lake City, with the Mormon Church thought to be a place with a great deal of social capital, is one of the best places in the U.S. to realize the American dream. It has some of the highest rates of social mobility. And when you see those very positive economic outcomes, as I've been emphasizing, they tend to go hand in hand with better health outcomes as well. The challenge we see is, you know, economists tend to gravitate towards solutions like investing in better schools or trying to change zoning laws and affordable housing policies. We have less of a sense of how to change those from a policy perspective, particularly in a scalable way. Mm-hmm. But when you're thinking about policy and how you might change things on scale, you tend to gravitate more naturally towards things that we're able to control mm-hmm. through, you know, funding for public schools or the way teachers are hired or things like that. So that's not by any means to diminish the importance of these other factors. Mm-hmm. I think we need to think creatively about how we might be able to set up systems that will change social capital and change networks more mm-hmm. systematically.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Raj Chetty, MacArthur Foundation Fellow and Professor of Public Economics at Stanford University. You can learn more about his work by going to inequality.stanford.edu/users/Raj-Chetty. And you can also find links to his work on Twitter. Dr. Chetty, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare for this very important conversation.
Thank you.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
After a mass shooting at a gay nightclub in Orlando, members of the House and the White House made seemingly contradictory claims about the Federal Drug Administration's blood donation policy for gay and bisexual men. California Representative Barbara Lee said that the FDA's one-year deferral policy, or celibacy, for men who have sex with men is, quote, based in fear and stigma, not science. The White House, meanwhile, claimed that the FDA's current policy does, quote, rely on scientific advice. In fact, the FDA's policy is supported by scientific evidence. However, a proposed alternative by Lee and others, an individual risk-based assessment, which would evaluate whether potential donors' behaviors put them at risk for transfusion-transmissible infections, also has scientific evidence to back it up. The FDA's original 1985 policy was a ban on any man who has had sex with another man since 1977. But in December 2015, the FDA changed that to a one-year deferral, citing the high prevalence of HIV in this population of men as support. All blood donations are tested for HIV, but those tests don't work until about 9 days after the virus is transmitted. But members of the House and other critics say the deferral is unnecessary. For instance, according to the FDA's own revised blood donation policy document, the prevalence of HIV infection among male blood donors who reported they had sex with men was much lower than the estimated HIV prevalence in the population of men reporting regular sex with men in general. The FDA policy document also says the risk of HIV transmission via blood transfusion was about 1 in 2,500 in the 1980s, and due to testing advancements, among other factors, it's now 1 in 1.47 million. By comparison, the odds of being struck by lightning in a lifetime is 1 in 12,000. Still, the Red Cross told us while technological capabilities minimizes the risk, they can't ensure donations are safe. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. You have cancer. These are words nobody wants to hear. Not only does the diagnosis conjure fear of the ravages of a potentially life-threatening illness, but it implies months of sickness associated with chemotherapy and other treatments. But a device that's already been approved for use in Europe and has just been approved by the FDA in this country can mitigate one of the more unpleasant side effects of hair loss. The DignaCap is a skull cap placed on the heads of chemo patients that cools the scalp and limits chemotherapy's toxic impact on the rapidly dividing cells in hair follicles.
Scalp cooling does in no way diminish the effectiveness of chemotherapy, nor does it increase the risk of recurrence.
That was Dr. Hope Rugo speaking to NBC News recently. She led the clinical trials at five different hospitals testing the efficacy of the DignaCap, which cools the scalp to 37 degrees, and that's cold enough to inhibit cell death in hair follicles.
You didn't choose to get your cancer. You can't affect the chemotherapy. This gives you something that you can do for yourself.
70% of the women in the trial kept more than 50% of their hair. And some, like Donna Tukes of Connecticut, kept all of it. She was selected for the trial after her husband, musician Daryl Tukes, wrote a letter asking that his wife be considered for the U.S. trial.
But I wrote a letter to several of the doctors conducting them.
And, a wonderful letter.
Donna has a head full of beautiful thick hair, a unique feature that is a shock of whiteness, creating a halo for her young face.
Not only did his wife keep her hair, her doctors say her early diagnosis and treatment have yielded an excellent outcome, cancer-free. DignaCap, a scalp-chilling device for patients undergoing chemotherapy, helping to preserve a sense of identity and dignity while enduring the rigors of cancer treatment and mitigating one of the most emotionally challenging side effects of that treatment, hair loss. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.